So after the death, murder, inhumanity, and excessive evil of the previous episode, I thought about dropping a palate cleanser today. That is to say, a palate cleanser by Dead Souls Social Club standards. So fear not, we'll still have death tonight, just not as full-on as our previous episode. So for the macabre and morbid amongst you, who, like me, grew up on mysteries and dark history, tonight's episode may intrigue you, but also give you something to think about. To ponder. Maybe even trigger that anxiety who likes to rear its ugly head at the most impromptu times. For those of you who've been with Dead Souls for a while, you'll probably remember the intro that we launched on our website back in October. We posed the question, are we really safe? Well, tonight we will reflect. Will the next person you meet on the street be the person who murders you? Will your next decision or judgment lead to your premature death? Because nothing you really know is certain. The world we live in is dark, dangerous, and to quote the Zodiac Killer, man is the most dangerous animal of all. Everything I'm going to tell you tonight is true, taken from police and credible press sources and well-researched historic documents that I've dug up. For though your soul may be eternal, your time on earth is a clock which is counting down. Think deeply, my friends. Actually, donate thoughts. When, where, and how do you think you will die? Will you succeed at life's game, or succumb to the turgid and evil whim of a hellion bent on controlling your existence end to satisfy their need to feel special, powerful, or just to destroy? These are short stories with tragic endings. Chapter 1. Poison. Early on the morning of September the 29th, 1982, a tragic medical mystery began to unfold with a young girl suffering from a sore throat and a blocked nose. It was then that Mary Kellerman, a 12-year-old girl from Elk Grove Village, a suburb of Chicago, told her mother and father about her symptoms. They gave her one extra strength Tylenol capsule. Mary was dead by 7 a.m. Mary had been rushed to hospital with heart failure, respiratory problems, and her organs were shutting down. But why? Was she allergic to Tylenol? She couldn't have been. These were not the symptoms of ingestion and allergic substance. Plus, she had taken it many times before. That same day, a 27-year-old postal worker named Adam Janus of Arlington Heights, Illinois, died of what was thought to be a massive heart attack. His brother and sister-in-law, Stanley, 25, and Teresa, 19, both of Leasel, Illinois, were both devastated by their loss, and after leaving the hospital, headed to his home to console their loved ones. Both were crippled with grief and experienced throbbing headaches, and each took a Tylenol capsule or two to ease their head pain. Stanley died that very same day, and Teresa died in hospital 2 days later. Police were called to the scene as three people dying in their mid-20s, all at the same time and in the same family, was a quandary of probability. They quickly linked the Tylenol to all three deaths. They'd all taken capsules from the same bottle. Police sent the contents of the bottle for testing, and when they discovered that young Molly Kellerman had ingested Tylenol just before her death, they tested her bottle too. The contents of all capsules in both bottles was potassium cyanide. Further, each capsule contained between 100 and 1,000 times the lethal dose for humans. Over the next few days, three more strange deaths occurred. 35-year-old Mary McFarland of Elmhurst, Illinois, 35-year-old Paul Prince of Chicago, and 27-year-old Mary Weiner of Winfield, Illinois. They had all taken Tylenol capsules just prior to their deaths. All their bottles, too, it emerged, had also been laced with massive doses of potassium cyanide. The news quickly broke that cyanide-laced Tylenol was on the shelves, and the nation erupted in a panic. What if it just wasn't Tylenol? What if citizens had already ingested cyanide? How long had it been a threat? How many people could be affected? Hospitals were flooded with people in fear, wanting to be checked over. Poison control hotlines were overwhelmed with calls, and extra operators had to be added. The police and FBI, now in possession of the Tylenol bottles, responsible for all the deaths, noted one thing that they all had in common. They were all from batch number MC2880. All bottles had a strong smell of bitter almonds to them, a telltale sign of the presence of potassium cyanide. The smell was stronger now, though, stronger than when the police first obtained the bottles from the victims' families. Federal forensic scientists examined the bottles. They deduced that the smell of the cyanide was increasing as the chemical gradually ate through the gelatin capsules. This meant that they could test the rate of chemical decay in the capsules and accurately estimate when the Tylenol was sabotaged and placed on the store shelves. The police managed to ascertain that whoever committed the crime had to have planted the tablets around September the 27th or 28th, just a day or two before they were purchased. Any longer and the cyanide would dissolve the capsules. Even though the poison bottles all shared the same batch number, Johnson & Johnson, the makers of Tylenol, informed the FBI that the five bottles in question had all been produced across three separate production factories. Further, they had all been purchased at different stores, five completely separate and independent drugstores. Fearing a mass poisoning scenario, the FBI advised Johnson & Johnson to recall all Tylenol products from stores with immediate effect. This was a sentiment that Johnson & Johnson shared, and a recall of over 31 million bottles was put into place at a cost to Johnson & Johnson of more than $100 million. Further, Johnson & Johnson also advertised a $100,000 reward for anyone who could provide the name or names of those responsible for the poisonings. Initially, the FBI had 1,200 leads and painstakingly investigated them all, investigating disgruntled ex-employees of the stores who sold the drugs and also Johnson & Johnson. Soon, the FBI would grow to suspect that this was a white-collar crime, and indeed, it did initially appear that way, especially given that Tylenol's market share dropped from 35% down to lower than 8%. In the 2 months after the initial deaths, there were 270 instances of copycat crimes across the US, using rat poison, hydrochloric acid, amongst other crude replica poisons. In the product recall, further bottles contaminated with potassium cyanide had been identified. In addition to the initial five poison bottles that killed the initial seven victims, another three bottles had been identified, making a total of eight tampered bottles of Tylenol. All were purchased or recalled from the Chicago metropolitan area. This narrowed the list of subjects down considerably. No fingerprints were found in any of the Tylenol bottles, other than the victims, and no CCTV cameras were used in the stores that the contaminated boxes were purchased from. The Chicago police made the decision to advertise the funerals of all the victims after agreement from the families. The police hoped, following consultation from the FBI's Behavioral Sciences Unit, that the perpetrator would attend the funerals in some capacity to admire their handiwork. An anonymous act such as these murders, where the aftermath would be very much in the public eye, would empower the perpetrator and give them a feeling of invincibility. They hold all the cards, and the events play out at their control. Police were convinced they wouldn't be able to resist. But no one came. At least no one the authorities would single out as being suspicious or out of place. The deaths would panic the entire nation, and would also cause a complete overhaul of the way medication was purchased and consumed, not just in the United States, but worldwide. In 1983, the US Congress passed what was called the Tylenol Bill, making it a federal offense to tamper with consumer products. In 1989, the FDA established federal guidelines for manufacturers to make all such products tamper-proof. Someone, police hypothesized, must have taken bottles off the shelves of local grocers and drugstores in the Chicago area, laced the capsules with poison, and then returned the restored packages to the shelves to be purchased by the unknown victims. To this day, however, the perpetrators of these murders have never been found. Chapter 2: The Road Ahead. On December the 12th, 2014, a little boy got off a school bus on a rural road in Economy, Pennsylvania, and stumbled upon something kind of unusual. It was a severed human head, lying in a field. The head belonged to an old woman. Investigators were able to determine through DNA profiling that she was local to either Pennsylvania or its surrounding states. But that's where all sense and rationale seems to have ended. She didn't match the profile of any missing person, and the rest of her body has never been found. So, was she a murder victim? Maybe someone who lived off the grid or a homeless person? Well, firstly, get this. The head had been professionally embalmed. That would mean that the head belonged to an already dead body that had been taken to a mortuary, except that no mortuary, hospital, or graveyard in the area had any knowledge of a missing head. And how the hell would any of those institutions even go about losing a head anyway? All sense seemed to be alleviated in this instance. The investigators couldn't tell whether the embalming was done legally, through the proper funerary process, or by some rogue hobbyist or fanboy in his or her basement or dungeon. Without anyone able to identify the identity of the human head, you, like me, would naturally assume it's more certainly the latter, right? Oh, I haven't finished yet. Part of the difficulty in identifying the head can be attributed to the fact that her eyes had been removed from the sockets. They had indeed been replaced by fake eyeballs. This is not so uncommon during the embalming process, actually. Natural eyes would often be removed and replaced by professionally made prosthetic ones. However, in this case, the fake ones were not the professional ones used by mortuaries. Oh no. They were rubber toy bouncy balls. The kind of bouncy balls that you'd widely get from vending machines outside grocery stores and in penny arcades. Investigators initially put forward that the head had either fallen off or been thrown from a moving vehicle, landing at the side of the road. But if so, these rubber eyes would likely have popped out. So the only deduction to take was that somebody, lovingly, placed the severed head right where it was found by the young schoolboy. To this day, the authorities have never been able to identify who the human head is, have never identified a body that's missing a head, or have not identified a professional institution that has lost a body or a head. So whoever did what they did to that head are still out there, still free, and have completely got away with decapitating a human being, removing their eyes, and setting it in a place where they wanted it to be found. Chances are, they may still even have the rest of the person's body in their possession. I think that's something to think about as you turn that final light off tonight, before going to bed. Chapter 3. Wake Up in Flames. Now this case is fairly local to me, just about an hour's drive up into the hills, which is why I wanted to include it here. Now most of you will have heard of the phenomenon known as spontaneous human combustion. This is where a human being, any human being, but usually seen in the elderly over around 60 years of age, will suddenly, and for no obvious reason, burst into flames and will ultimately burn to death. Now usually in reported cases of spontaneous human combustion, there will only be a small body part remaining, a foot, an arm, part of a leg, but the rest of the body is burned to ash. All flesh, all bones, gone. Nothing remains. Now, when researching crematoria for this episode, I looked into how hot the incinerators, or the retort as it's known in a crematorium, burn when they cremate a body after the death. They will burn for around 1,000 degrees Celsius for around 2 hours. That's about 1,830 degrees Fahrenheit for my transatlantic friends. At the end of which, there will still be bones present and they will have to grind down to create the even ash that is presented to the family in an urn or cremation box. Yes, in cases of spontaneous human combustion, the entire body, including bones, are reduced to ash. Further, items in the same room as the combusting body remain unaffected. Even though a body is burning at 1,000 degrees, or hotter, only a few feet away, items remain intact. Really weird, huh? Crazy and science-defying, even. Well, there are actually many, many cases of spontaneous human combustion worldwide. Look up the case of Mary Risa or Michael Fahati online for yourselves. But I'm going to talk about a case that happened in 1980 in the small Welsh town of Ebbw Vale. Henry Thomas was a 73-year-old man who lived alone and who was found burned to death in the living room of his modest council house on the Rasa council estate. When his body was found, it was completely incinerated, leaving only his skull, which had been shrunk in size, and a portion of his leg below the knee. The feet and legs were clothed in socks and trouser legs. The fire had also destroyed half of the chair in which he had been sitting and melted the central knobs of a television some meters away. The television set was still on when police arrived the day after his death. The victim's spectacles were sitting neatly folded in the grate of the open fire, within an arm's reach of the position of the chair. The victim's slippers were on the carpet just beyond his unburned feet, suggesting Mr. Thomas had eased his slippers off and settled back to watch television before being burned. The police officer who attended the scene was John E. Hamer, and what follows is taken from his own notes on the incident. He said, and I quote, "The living room was bathed in an orange glow, coming from windows and a light bulb. This orange light was the result of daylight and electric light being filtered by evaporated human fat which had condensed on the surfaces. The remainder of the house was completely undamaged." Hamer described the room in which the death occurred as comfortably warm, despite the fact that the house was halfway up a mountain in the middle of a Welsh winter with the temperatures being well below freezing, and the house had no double glazing or central heating, as was the time and location of the rural house. The room was warm because of such high heat levels that had been absorbed into the walls during the fire, slowly being re-released back into the room. The temperature during the fire had evidently been high enough to melt elements of the television set, which was some meters away from Thomas's remains, and to soften a plastic light shade sufficiently for it to slide off its fittings and fall to the floor. But a coal fire in the grate had gone out. There was no sign of disturbance to the fireplace, and no evidence of any injury occurring there. A stack of chopped sticks suitable for laying in a fire had been prepared by Thomas and was sitting ready by the fire tools. Thomas's ashes lay on top of the rug and a foam-backed carpet, both of which were only burned where they were in contact with the ashes, and thermoplastic tiles under the carpet, which should have been permanently marked by the proximity of the heat source, were unblemished. Police officer Hamer questioned Mr. Thomas's neighbour. He found that the night before the ashes were discovered, the neighbour had gone out into the garden and seen foul-smelling smoke coming from Thomas's chimney. He had assumed Thomas was burning rubbish on his open fire. Pathologists found that Thomas had been alive when he began to burn, as his blood, taken from the remains of his legs, contained a high level of carbon monoxide. So Henry Thomas burst into flames alive and burned to death. Police officer Hamer reached the following conclusions. The body had begun to burn properly while seated in the chair. The chair had caught fire while in contact with the body. When one side of the chair had burned sufficiently, it collapsed, depositing the body on the floor. Now out of contact with the body, the unburned portion of the chair ceased to burn. The body continued to burn until only the skull and lower legs were left. More so, Hamer stated that the lack of fire damage to the rest of the room indicated a rapid blaze, which went out before anything that was not in direct contact with the victim had caught light. Thomas's death was ruled as death by burning by the coroner. He had plainly inhaled the contents of his own combustion. Haunting, isn't it? We found the location of the house where this took place recently and paid them a visit to see if they could share any additional information with us during our research for this episode. Unfortunately, the family who now live in this house had never heard of what had happened in the winter of 1980, and I think we may have inadvertently given them a few sleepless nights. So anyway, thank you for joining us tonight, and thanks for listening to this different kind of episode. We'll be back later this week with another in-depth and singular-focused episode, so subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and also follow us on Instagram. You can find us at dead_souls_podcast for daily mysteries, dark history, and podcast updates. And if you're checking out our Instagram, you may as well also check out our Patreon, where you can also get extra rewards, so head on over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/deadsouls. Show us some love, show us some support, and join the Dead Souls Social Club. So thanks everyone, take care of yourselves, and sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.